Chapter 30. But I want you to understand, Mr. Dot S. He had actually to think of my name. Dot Mr. Marlowe, that I have written to Mrs. Fine, that I haven't been, that I have done nothing to make Captain Anthony behave to me as he had behaved. I haven't. It isn't my doing. It isn't my fault, if she likes to put it in that way. But she, with her ideas, ought to understand that I couldn't. Dot dot I know she hates me now. I think she never liked me. I think nobody ever cared for me. I was told once nobody could care for me, and I think it is true. At any rate, I can't forget it. Her abominable experience with the governess had implanted in her unlucky breast a lasting doubt, an ineradicable suspicion of herself and of others. I said, "Remember, Mr. Barrel, that to be fair you must trust a man altogether or not at all." She dropped her eyes suddenly. I thought I heard a faint sigh. I tried to take a light tone again, and yet it seemed impossible to get off the ground which gave me my standing with her. Mrs. Fine is absurd. She's an excellent woman, but really you could not be expected to throw away your chance of life simply that she might cherish a good opinion of your memory. That would be excessive. It was not of my life that I was thinking while Captain Anthony was speaking to me, said Florida Barrow with an effort. I told her that she was wrong then. She ought to have been thinking of her life, and not only of her life, but of the life of the man who was speaking to her too. She let me finish, then shook her head impatiently. I mean death. Well, I said, when he stood before you there, outside the cottage, he really stood between you and that. I have it out of your own mouth. You can't deny it. If you will have it, that he saved my life, then he has got it. It was not for me. Oh no. It was not for me, that it was not fear. There. She finished petulantly. And you may just as well know it. She hung her head, and swung the parasol slightly to and fro. I thought a little. Do you know French, Mr. Barrel? I asked. She made a sign with her head that she did, but without showing any surprise at the question, and without ceasing to swing her parasol. Well then, somehow or other I have the notion that Captain Anthony is what the French call un gallant homme. I should like to think he is being treated as he deserves. The form of her lips, I could see them under the brim of her hat, was suddenly altered into a line of seriousness. The parasol stopped swinging. I have given him what he wanted, that's myself, she said without a tremor, and with a striking dignity of tone. Impressed by the manner and the directness of the words, I hesitated for a moment what to say, then made up my mind to clear up the point. And you have got what you wanted? Is that it? The daughter of the egregious financier de Barrel did not answer at once this question going to the heart of things. Then raising her head and gazing wistfully across the street noisy with the endless transit of innumerable bargains, she said with intense gravity, "He has been most generous." I was pleased to hear these words. Not that I doubted the infatuation of Roderick Anthony, but I was pleased to hear something which proved that she was sensible and open to the sentiment of gratitude which in this case was significant. In the face of man's desire, a girl is excusable if she thinks herself priceless. I mean a girl of our civilization which has established a dithyrambic phraseology for the expression of love. A man in love will accept any convention exalting the object of his passion and in this indirect way his passion itself. In what way the captain of the ship Ferndale gave proofs of lover-like lavishness I could not guess very well. But I was glad she was appreciative. It is lucky that small things please women. And it is not silly of them to be thus pleased. It is in small things that the deepest loyalty, that which they need most, the loyalty of the passing moment, is best expressed. As he had remained thoughtful, letting her deep motionless eyes rest on the streaming jumble of traffic, suddenly she said, "And I wanted to ask you. Dot dot I was really glad when I saw you actually here. Who would have expected you here, at this spot, before this hotel? I certainly never. You see, it meant a lot to me. You are the only person who knows. Who knows for certain. Knows what? I said, not discovering at first what she had in her mind. Then I saw it. I can't believe that alone. I remonstrated, rather annoyed at the invidious position she was forcing on me in a sense. "'Tis true that I was the only person to see," I added. "But, as it happens, after your mysterious disappearance I told the Fiennes the story of our meeting." Her eyes raised to mine, had an expression of dreamy, unfathomable candor, if I dare say so. And if you wonder what I mean, I can only say that I have seen the sea wear such an expression on one or two occasions shortly before sunrise on a calm, fresh day. She said, as if meditating aloud, that she supposed the Fiennes were not likely to talk about that. She couldn't imagine any connection in which. Why should they? As her tone had become interrogatory, I assented. Oh, be sure. There's no reason whatever, thinking to myself, that they would be more likely indeed to keep quiet about it. They had other things to talk of. And then, remembering little Fiennes stuck upstairs for an unconscionable time, enough to blurt out everything he ever knew in his life, I reflected that he would assume naturally that Captain Anthony had nothing to learn from him about Florida Barrel. It had been up to now my assumption to. I saw my mistake. The sincerest of women will make no unnecessary confidences to a man. And this is as it should be. No, I said reassuringly. 'Tis most unlikely. Are you much concerned? Well, you see, when I came down, she said again in that precise demure tone, when I came down into the garden, Captain Anthony misunderstood, of course he would. Men are so conceited, I said. I saw it well enough that he must have thought as he had come down to him. What else could he have thought? And then he had been gentleness itself. A new experience for that poor, delicate, and yet so resisting creature. Gentleness in passion. What could have been more seductive to the scared, starved heart of that girl? Perhaps had he been violent, she might have told him that what she came down to keep was the tryst of death, not of love. It occurred to me as I looked at her, young, fragile in aspect, and intensely alive in her quietness, that perhaps she did not know herself then what sort of tryst she was coming down to keep. She smiled faintly, almost awkwardly, as if she were totally unused to smiling at my cheap jocularity. Then she said with that forced precision, a sort of conscious primness, "I didn't want him to know." I approved heartily. "Quite right. Much better. Let him ever remain under his misapprehension, which was so much more flattering for him." I tried to keep it in the tone of comedy, but she was, I believe, too simple to understand my intention. She went on, looking down. "Oh, you think so? When I saw you, I didn't know why you were here. I was glad when you spoke to me, because this is exactly what I wanted to ask you for. I wanted to ask you, if you ever meet Captain Anthony by any chance anywhere, you are a sailor too, are you not? That you would never mention never that you had seen me over there." "My dear young lady," I cried, horror-struck at the supposition. "Why should I? What makes you think I should dream of?" As he had raised her head at my vehemence. She did not understand it. The world had treated her so dishonorably that he had no notion, even of what mere decency of feeling is like. It was not her fault. Indeed, I don't know why she should have put her trust in anybody's promises. But I thought it would be better to promise. So I assured her that she could depend on my absolute silence. "I am not likely to ever set eyes on Captain Anthony," I added with conviction as a further guarantee. She accepted my assurance in silence, without a sign. Her gravity had in it something acute, perhaps because of that chin. While we were still looking at each other, she declared, "There's no deception in it, really. I want you to believe that, if I am here, like this, today, it is not from fear. It is not. I quite understand, I said. But her firm yet self-conscious gaze became doubtful. Do, I insisted. Understand perfectly that it was not of death, that you were afraid. She lowered her eyes slowly, and I went on. As to life, that's another thing. And I don't know that one ought to blame you very much, though it seemed rather an excessive step. I wonder now, if it isn't the ugliness, rather than the pain of the struggle which... Dot, she shuddered visibly. But I do blame myself, she exclaimed with feeling. Am ashamed. And, dropping her head, she looked in a moment the very picture of remorse and shame. Well, you will be going away from all its horrors, I said. Andy, surely you are not afraid of the sea. You are a sailor's granddaughter, I understand. She sighed deeply. She remembered her grandfather only a little. He was a clean-shaven man with a ruddy complexion and long, perfectly white hair. He used to take her on his knee, and putting his face near hers, talk to her in loving whispers. If only he were alive now. Dot dot exclamation point, she remained silent for a while. Aren't you anxious to see the ship? I asked. She lowered her head still more, so that I could not see anything of her face. I don't know, she murmured. I had already the suspicion that she did not know her own feelings. All this work of the merest chance had been so unexpected, so sudden. And as he had nothing to fall back upon, no experience but such as to shake her belief in every human being. She was dreadfully and pitifully forlorn. It was almost in order to comfort my own depression that I remarked cheerfully. Well, I know of somebody who must be growing extremely anxious to see you. I am before my time, she confessed simply, rousing herself. Had nothing to do. So I came out. I had the sudden vision of a shabby, lonely little room at the other end of the town. It had grown intolerable to her restlessness. The mere thought of it oppressed her. Flora DeBarrel was looking frankly at her chance confidant. And I came this way, she went on. Appointed the time myself yesterday, but Captain Anthony would not have minded. He told me he was going to look over some business papers till I came. The idea of the son of the poet, the rescuer of the most forlorn damsel of modern times, the man of violence, gentleness, and generosity, sitting up to his neck in ship's accounts amused me. I'm sure he would not have minded, I said, smiling. But the girl's stare was somber, her thin white face seemed pathetically careworn. I can hardly believe yet, she murmured anxiously. It's quite real. Never fear, I said encouragingly, but had to change my tone at once. You had better go down that way a little, I directed her abruptly. I had seen Fine come striding out of the hotel door. The intelligent girl, without staying to ask questions, walked away from me quietly down one street, while I hurried on to meet Fine coming up the other at his efficient pedestrian gait. My object was to stop him getting as far as the corner. He must have been thinking too hard to be aware of his surroundings. I put myself in his way, and he nearly walked into me. Hello, I said. His surprise was extreme. Ooh here. You don't mean to say you have been waiting for me? I said negligently that I had been detained by unexpected business in the neighborhood, and thus happened to catch sight of him coming out. He stared at me with solemn distraction, obviously thinking of something else. I suggested that he had better take the next city ward tramcar. He was inattentive, and I perceived that he was profoundly perturbed. As Miss DeBarrel, as he had moved out of sight, could not possibly approach the hotel door, as long as we remained where we were, I proposed that we should wait for the car on the other side of the street. He obeyed rather the slight touch on his arm than my words, and while we were crossing the wide roadway in the midst of the lumbering wheeled traffic, he exclaimed in his deep tone, I don't know which of these two is more mad than the other. Really? I said, pulling him forward from under the noses of two enormous sleepy-headed cart horses. He skipped wildly out of the way, and up on the curbstone with a purely instinctive precision. His mind had nothing to do with his movements. In the middle of his leap, and while in the act of sailing gravely through the air, he continued to relieve his outraged feelings. You would never believe. They are mad. I took care to place myself in such a position that to face me, he had to turn his back on the hotel across the road. I believe he was glad I was there to talk to. But I thought there was some misapprehension in the first statement he shot out at me without. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.